Hey folks, this is Shag from FirestormFan.com. I've got a special treat for you. An interview with Jerry Conway, Firestorm co-creator and the man that wrote Firestorm's Adventures for 9 years. Jerry agreed to this interview for FirestormFan.com and was incredibly generous with his time. The interview goes about 80 minutes, so I've broken it up into two chunks. We'll be listening to about 50 minutes today, and the other 30 minutes will be posted later this week to FirestormFan.com. The first half covers things like coming up with the idea for Firestorm, a never-before-revealed fact about Professor Stein's creation, working with artists Pat Brodjick and Raphael Kayanin, Jerry's thoughts on Firestorm's costume, the DC implosion, how Killer Croc was almost a Firestorm villain, why he eventually left the Firestorm title, and much, much more. Jerry was absolutely wonderful to talk with. I think you're really going to enjoy his insightful and often funny thoughts on Firestorm. If you liked the interview, be sure to stop by FirestormFan.com and let us know. Now, enough of me rambling. Let's get to the interview. I'm here with Jerry Conway. Jerry Conway is an American writer of comic books and television shows. He's best known for co-creating the Marvel Comics character The Punisher with artist Ross Andrew and scripting the death of Gwen Stacy during his long run of The Amazing Spider-Man. He's also known for scripting the first major modern-day intercompany crossover, Superman vs. The Amazing Spider-Man. Jerry has written significant runs on comic books such as Spider-Man, Justice League of America, Fantastic Four, Superman, Iron Man, Detective Comics, Avengers, and many, many more. He was one of the more prolific comic book writers during the 1970s and 80s, and he was even the Marvel Comics editor-in-chief at one point. He also wrote for and produced such TV series as Law & Order, Diagnosis Murder, Father Dowling Mysteries, and many more. If you're new to comics and aren't familiar with Jerry's work, just think of it this way. He was the Jeff Johns of the 1970s and 80s. He wrote everything, and it was all brilliant. Well, Jerry recently – go ahead.
I'm flattered beyond words to be compared to Jeff, so that's great.
Well, you were Jeff first. Jerry recently returned to comics after almost a 20-year absence. He wrote a very insightful miniseries entitled The Last Days of Animal Man, which you should still be able to find in stores now. Jerry, along with artist Al Milgrom, also created the character of Firestorm the Nuclear Man. Firestorm was very successful for DC, and Jerry stayed involved with the hero for about 8 years. That's the work we're going to be talking about today. Now, Jerry, I can't thank you enough for spending time just talking to me and giving this interview for the people that read FirestormFan.com.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and I'm flattered, as I say, that you want to talk about it.
I'm a big fan. I first found the character, believe it or not, on the Super Friends cartoon. I know, it's not the most auspicious place to...
Oh, listen, I'm happy with that, however anybody finds them.
Well, I ran right out of the store after watching the first episode that Firestorm was on, and I picked up Firestorm 28 and issue 30. Those were the two I could find. It took me forever to find 29, I don't know why, but picked up all the back issues, and I just, you know, it was great to find that character when I did. It was early enough in the series that I felt like I could get in on the ground floor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, youthful appeal, and he was funny, and the dual identity. It was really neat to see Martin Stein, an older character, you know, running around as a superhero.
Yes.
Really unusual.
Much and very unwilling to do so, which I kind of enjoyed.
I loved the interplay between Ronnie and the professor throughout the series. That was fantastic. It's, you know, it seems like every issue there's some comment of something like, you know, what do you need now, Ronnie? Or you better have a good reason for this.
Yeah. Well, I kind of conceived him to a small degree as, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this to anybody, but I thought of him as Julie Schwartz. He kind of actually looked a little like Julie, you know, he was kind of balding and, bespeckled as Julie was. And he had a kind of, Julie was one of these extremely smart, very dry, older guys from a different generation, just like Martin Stein was, who nonetheless found himself surrounded by very young people who were very enthusiastic about work that he had probably wasn't. I mean, it's not that he wasn't enthusiastic about it anymore, but he had a kind of a jaded sense. So I think writing Martin, in some sense, I was sort of, you know, doing a little tribute to Julie.
That's fantastic. I had an opportunity to see him speak before he passed away, and what a neat man.
Oh, yeah. Really a terrific guy.
Yeah.
An extremely talented editor and somebody who was a huge influence on my work over the years.
In some previous interviews, speaking of Firestorm's creation, you mentioned that he was your attempt to do a DC version of a Marvel character.
Right.
how did you, what was the germ of the idea for Firestorm, and what were some of the Marvel traits you were trying to emulate?
Well, I'd had a long association with Marvel through many years of writing for them, and I really enjoyed writing the Marvel material, and I particularly enjoyed writing Spider-Man, which was, you know, a kind of an iconic youthful character who I identified with to a large degree in during the period in which I was writing him. I started writing Spider-Man, I guess, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and, you know, I was kind of contemporary in age with Peter Parker and sort of shared some of his feelings. Anyway, I wanted to get some of that back, and I wanted to write something at DC that allowed me to do that, and there weren't that many young characters available at DC. On top of that, DC was doing this, was trying to create some new characters, and they had a new deal for creators that allowed us to gain some ownership in the material. I mean, not ownership in the sense of a copyright, but we would participate in the in any benefits that accrued. So that was an inspiration. You know, I said, "Oh, this'd be nice to do." So combine that with this feeling that I had that there was room in the business for another young superpowered character, but I didn't want to do another Peter Parker. In other words, another guy who was smart, you know, and you know, witty from a really clever point of view, you know, and had this, had everything on the ball once he became Spider-Man. Because he was sublimating his inadequacies in his real life. I thought, well, what about what if Flash Thompson, you know, the old Spider-Man antagonist for Peter, had been the one to get the powers? You know, what if the dumb guy, you know, had gotten the powers rather than the smart guy? Not to say that Ronnie was dumb, but, you know, he was not a brain. Which becomes obvious in the very first story when he lets himself get talked into doing something incredibly stupid just to impress a girl. I mean, it's like, you know, he's just not the smartest, you know, guy in the room. But I didn't want to have a dumb superhero. So at the same time, I wanted to have, you know, give him a side that was reflective and intelligent. And just as Peter Parker represented what I was going through when I was writing him as a young man. By the time I was writing Firestorm, I was in my late 20s to early 30s, and I was more mature. And I guess I was at that point where I was starting to look back and reflect on some of the things that seemed, you know, cool to me as a younger guy. So I had this kind of dual mind going on, you know, where I was looking at it both as the young part of myself and the older part of myself. So that, you know, sort of popped into my head. And the final thing was, I was a fan, not as much as, say, Roy Thomas was, but I was a fan of Captain Marvel. And I always loved the idea of Billy Batson, you know, this kid, becoming Captain Marvel, but I didn't think it went far enough, you know, because once he became Captain Marvel, he was Captain Marvel. I thought, well, you know, what if Billy was still present? You know, I mean, what if you really got a sense that Billy was still there? So that gave me the thought of, you know, what if there was another persona floating over over the superhero, you know, sort of commenting and acting like a Greek chorus, you know, giving insights and unwelcome advice, you know, and so on. So that was basically the gestation of it.
You definitely kept it fun and lighthearted, and that was definitely in a time when comics were becoming more serious. Did you do anything different when you're writing Firestorm versus other titles to keep it from getting dragged into the more serious, or I shouldn't say serious, but the darker, you know, era of comics?
As I say, I was trying to do something that was fun from to a large degree. What I was doing with Firestorm was trying to replicate the experience that I had as a reader of the original Spider-Man comics, because I picked up Spider-Man probably around issue 2 or 3 and ran with, you know, read the series, you know, up until the mid to late 60s pretty assiduously. And I was a very big fan of that fun villain of the month, you know, a great new storyline, you know, things constantly percolating, you know, and I had the opportunity with Firestorm, because he was not tied into the DC universe in a strong way, to do that same kind of rediscovering, you know, a superhero from the beginning. And that's really what I tried to do. So I tried to make it as fun for the contemporary reader at the time, as my experience of Spider-Man had been fun for me.
So. It was definitely evocative of that, as you said, villain of the month. I mean, there were so many interesting villains that came out every month. There, a lot of them had sort of tragic circumstances which led to their powers.
Sure.
I definitely could see where Spider-Man was the inspiration for that, yet it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a carbon copy by any
means. No. I mean,
it was its own creature.
Absolutely. I mean, and I a lot of that is due to the terrific artwork that I was blessed with, and the artists that I was blessed with working with. I mean, particularly, you know, obviously Pat Broderick, who took over after Al Milgram. I mean, Al was obviously extremely important to the creation of the book, but Pat, I think, is what made it a really solid, successful title for them for many months. And then when Raphael came on, he also contributed quite a bit to the overall fun feel of the book. These guys Absolutely. Weren't drawing like other DC characters. I mean, they were outside that DC look.
I definitely agree. You had the early on, I think, I didn't realize this till the other day, but George Perez's very first DC work was for you in a Firestorm backup in Flash.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
I know. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I hadn't even realized that myself until recently, so it's kind of fun. You know, I'd known George, obviously, when he was working at Marvel, so mm-hmm. with him at DC was a great opportunity.
Now, you're talking about all the different artists you work with. Were there some of the characteristics that the artist brought to the Firestorm, where did any of them inspire you to change a character or a plot? And did you write full script or plot first and the collaborative relationships with them?
For the most part, I did it Marvel style, you know, where we plotted, where the story would be plotted and then the artist would develop it. Pat and Raphael both had such different approaches. I'm talking about them primarily because they did the most work on the book. This is, again, not to
Sure.
diminish Al's contribution at all, because Al set the tone, you know, for the book. But working with Pat and with Raphael, you know, they both had different strengths and weaknesses as artists. I mean, Pat, I thought, you know, was a very dynamic storyteller. He had a kind of a fun quality to his work. You know, there was a lightness to it that Raphael didn't have. So the book sort of, I think, when Raphael took it over, it became a little darker and a little bit more intense in certain mm-hmm. ways. To that extent, you know, the artists influenced the direction of the books. When you're working with an artist, you and the artist are very much a team, even if you're not necessarily aware of it, because there's a kind of this unspoken communication going back and forth, like an unspoken conversation. Even if you're having a spoken conversation, there's also this subtext, you know, of what you're learning from each other in terms of storytelling and in terms of the strengths and weaknesses that each of you bring to the material. So the artist will do things to try to cover my weaknesses, or will do things that work to my strengths, and I will do things that work to his strengths and cover his weaknesses, and so on. So
fantastic. Did you get a chance to communicate with any of the artists during that?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, I knew I would talk with Pat on occasion. I was also the editor of the book, so I would be talking with Pat all the time, and Raphael also. You know, I brought Raphael onto the book through the aegis of Mike Friedrich, who I think was at that time his agent, and my agent too, for a brief period there. So, working with both of them. You know, I talked to them, and we probably didn't communicate as much as I say communicated with Ross Andrew when I was working on Spider-Man. But that was a different time, you know, in my life, and my work schedule was different. I was writing tons of material for DC at the time that I was doing Spider-Man.
Right. You mentioned that you took over as editor during that first year of the Fury of the Firestorm title. How did that change things for you when you're going from writer to writer and editor?
Well, I had been kind of the writer editor of my own work over at Marvel for many years, even though you don't, if the title of writer editor didn't come into play at Marvel until Roy Thomas quit as editor in chief and became writer editor of his own books. Mm-hmm. Most of us who were writing titles were in effect our own editors. Marvel was publishing something like 50 or 60 titles a month during this period, and Roy was the editor, quote, you know, of all of them, which is ridiculous. I mean, he wasn't the editor, but what he was doing was he was the editorial director, and the individual writers were in effect the editors of their own books. We would run stories past Roy in a general sense, and then we'd write, you know, like 2-3 issues, 4 issues, you know, without really getting a lot of feedback from him. I mean, he would come in and maybe change things, you know, a line or two here or there, but it was not editorial oversight as it's conceived today. So when I came over to DC for about a year in the mid-70s, I was a writer editor, you know, of my own material. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to DC, even though I wasn't in the beginning a writer editor, it was my goal to, at least on a select handful of titles, to edit my own material, because I was comfortable doing that, and I didn't see any reason why, given my, you know, track record and my perception, you know, my ability to do it, you know, why I would need, you know, editorial oversight. Of course, we all need editorial oversight, but that was my attitude at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
gonna change tactics on you for just a second. Actually, I have a question from my 10-year-old stepson. he's a fan of Firestorm. He's seen Firestorm in the Super Friends cartoon. He has a couple of the action figures, and when he found out I was going to be speaking to you, he got very excited, and he made me promise him that I would ask you 2 questions for him.
Okay.
The first one is, why did you name him Firestorm? And I'm quoting him. Why did you name him Firestorm if he doesn't have fire powers? he was very confused by that.
Okay. Well, Firestorm, the name actually refers to the aftermath of a nuclear blast. Is a firestorm. And so that was part of it. You know, I knew his powers were going to be nuclear, so I wanted that kind of a name. And then secondly, I had from the very beginning, when I first conceived the character, I had this image of this head that was on fire. So I wanted to tie it into that as well. But it's a combination of the two. I mean, a firestorm is the aftermath of a nuclear blast, and of course, a nuclear blast is what started gave him his powers. And the fire is a reflection of his head, which is a giant, which is a giant matchstick.
Right. Can't miss it, though.
Yeah, kids, don't try this at home.
Exactly. I'd read
talk about the most irresponsible character in the history of comics, next to Human Torch. You know, it's like
right. That famous story with the kid and the gasoline.
Oh,
right.
Please. Oh, I mean the horror. We don't want to see that happen.
Absolutely not. One more question from my stepson, again quoting him. Why did you have Firestorm join the Justice League of America? And the reason my stepson asks is because I try to be a pretty involved parent. I get down on the floor, we play with action figures and do stuff. And whenever the Firestorm action figure comes out, he gets mad because Firestorm can do anything as far as he's concerned. And he's like, Firestorm doesn't even need the Justice League. Why would you have him join the Justice League?
Well, because he's not terribly competent, you know. Let's be fair. Part of the thing is that he's a kid and he doesn't really know exactly what he's doing. So he does need mentoring. But from a practical point of view, what actually happened there was I was writing the Justice League. And after the Firestorm book was canceled, after licking my wounds for a few months, you know, I really wanted to bring him back. And I think the first place I brought him back was in a Superman team-up story of some kind.
Absolutely right. And DC Comics Presents.
Right. And then that led to, I I don't know if the Action Comics backup feature happened at that point, or if we brought him into Justice League right away. But just bringing him into Justice League was a tactical maneuver on my part to raise his profile and to show that he had popularity, so that DC would bring him back into put him back in his own book, and it worked. You know, that's pretty much what did it. It was a combination of those things.
I think you'll be very happy with that answer.
Oh, good. Well, I mean, it's two things. You know, one from a character point of view, he needs adult supervision, or at least he did in that persona. And from a practical point of view, it was a method of getting him back in front of the readers.
Sort of a silly question for you. Firestorm's costume is obviously very iconic. I mean, you see him, you can't mistake him, and it's really classic. I mean, the way that Al Milgrom designed him. However, comic fans have mocked the puffy sleeves from time to time. What's your take on that?
Well, they weren't funny at the time. I think Al's thought was, and I think it was a smart one, was that, you know, we've seen all of these superheroes, and they had the same silhouette, you know, which was the silhouette is what you see when you just see the character from a distance. And if you think about all the superheroes that are out now, I mean, pretty much all of them, if you just saw them in silhouette, looked the same, except for Firestorm, who, because of both the shoulder flanges and the hair, the flaming hair and the puffy sleeves, cannot be mistaken for anybody else. And that's deliberate. So it's silly, but, you know, it's the puffy shirt, you know, the Seinfeld episode. You know, you can't get away from it. We didn't mean it, because obviously we did it well before the Seinfeld episode. You know, we also thought of it as the pirate shirt, you know, and things like that.
Yeah.
And it goes back to a degree. You can also say that it's very similar to the original Green Lantern's outfit, because he also had a kind of a loose fitting. Semi-puffy shirt.
You know, you're absolutely... I didn't think about that. You're absolutely... the way Marty Nodell designed him, it is kind of puffy.
Huh. Yeah, it's very loose, and that also gives him a different, you know, iconic look.
Absolutely so, true.
Just something else. Just something else that we try to draw on.
Now, looking over the history of Firestorm's publication, you wrote nearly every single appearance of the character from, like, 1977 through 1986. This includes both the Firestorm series, the Flash backups, the JLA appearances, DC Comics Presents, Brave and the Bold, on and on and on. And it's something like 100 comics altogether. Yeah. Was that by design that you wrote all of his appearances, or did it just kind of happen that way?
Well, it was my character. I wanted to write all of it. And, I mean, I would have continued writing it if they had let me. So, you know, it was never my desire it's not that I didn't think anybody else could do it. It's just, he was my character.
Right.
I wasn't going to give him up.
Was anyone asking to use him?
You know, there really weren't that many opportunities to use him outside of the venues that we were using him in. He didn't really fit into the regular DC universe. I mean, having him in JLA is kind of weird, you know, in a sense. I mean, it fits better now, but back then he was really odd for that series. You know, he was, most of those characters were fairly mature, level-headed, straightforward figures, you know, and here's this kid, you know, kind of bouncing around like Snapper Carr, you know, with a flaming head. So I think it was, other people probably didn't really feel like that there was a way to use him, you know. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a lot of cross fertilization as there is now among the different people working on different comics. Everybody had their own little fiefdom and was happy to stay in it.
Gotcha. Do you have any favorite issues or storylines from your time on Firestorm?
I have favorite characters. I was particularly fond of Killer Frost. I used her a lot, I think. I liked... I was fond of Firehawk, you know, I thought was a neat development for him. You know, I mean, the Hyena was fun. The Cyclone. I mean, you know, there were a lot of. I mean, the thing about the way I was doing that book was that I wasn't trying to do memorable stories per se, you know, where you were looking at it and remembered a particularly clever twist or a particularly dramatic situation. I was trying to do a continuing storyline with this kid, you know, who had these superpowers. And so my goal wasn't to write a really terrific issue that you'll really remember. It was more like to write a really good year, you know, that you'll remember. Mm. So that was the approach. And the different supervillains were ways to sort of punctuate that and to give you a reason to pick up a different issue, you know, just to see what's this guy going to do? What's that guy? Multiplex, one of my favorite characters. I mean, just the idea of this guy every time he copies himself, instead of becoming more powerful, he becomes less powerful. I mean, it's like, that's just great, you know?
So the physics behind that's really interesting that you took the time to think that through.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually it was, I think, based on something that that Len Wein had said to me about I think he had a character called the Carbon Copy Man. I believe he did. I'm not sure. But he was saying, you know, that realistically, with the Carbon Copy Man, you know, every time he made a copy of himself, he'd get lighter and lighter until he sort of just disappeared. And I thought, oh yeah, you know, I guess I'd be kind of, you know, one of these guys who splits themselves, you know, because I think there was an X-Men villain who could do that, and then Duo Damsel. I mean, where does the mask come from? You know, it's like the mask would basically stay the same, so they'd get smaller and smaller. So that was the fun of it, you know. Just take it to its take these iconic ideas and try to flip them on their head.
I love that cover where all the little pint-sized multiplexes are taking Firestorm down.
Yeah, the punch. It's like Lilliput, you know, the Lilliputians.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, were there any characters that, you know, you discovered after a while that you really didn't care for? Like, maybe when you created with an intention, after a while, you're like, oh, this character's not going anywhere for me.
Yeah, Cliff Carmichael. I mean, he was a pretty one-note sort of character. I don't think I really did that much with him after a while. But, you know, for the most part, my focus was on Ronnie and the professor and their interactions, and everybody else was there primarily to provide a foil for that, you know, to some degree. You know, so the professor would have somebody he was interested in romantically, you know, and then that would provide a foil, you know, and then Ronnie would have someone, you know, and so on, you know. It was just having fun, you know, one issue after another, trying to keep it going.
You did a sort of an interesting, I don't know if it was an experiment, but with the Fury of Firestorm Annual Number 2, it was an illustrated novella. And for those who are listening that have never read it, it was all text with just a few illustrations on each page. I mean, there were no word balloons or anything. And this was a big departure for standard comics.
Yeah.
How did you approach writing that?
I don't remember how it was received, and I have no idea why I did it. Other than I was trying again to sort of change things up for myself, you know. I thought this would be kind of interesting. I think Pat Broderick and I were talking about it, and because I think Pat was the one who did the art for that. Am I a writer, or was it Rafi?
I'd have to go back and check. I don't honestly remember.
Yeah, I think it was Pat, because Pat was on the book for a couple of years. But we were talking about it, you know, and I and the artist, you know, and I said, you know, it'd be fun sometime to do this as a you know, as a storybook in some way, you know, just try something a little bit different for both of us. And he responded well to it, I guess. And, you know, I was editing the material, I believe. So it wasn't there was nobody I had to ask other than, you know, talk to Dick Giordano, and Dick was always interested in doing something different, you know? So we did it, you know, and I think it probably did well enough, but it was bizarre. It was strange to do. I had written fiction. I had written novels and short stories. And I guess I wanted to, you know, to try my hand at that again. And that gave me the opportunity to do it.
it was really interesting. I mean, as a reader too, it was very different and made for a very interesting reading experience. You know, getting into the character in a different way through prose, which was neat.
Yeah.
So this fan received it well. So.
Well, good. I'm glad. That's what's important. You know, that somebody reads it and enjoys it.
We've talked a little bit about the first volume of Firestorm that was canceled during the so-called DC implosion.
Yes.
Number six was never published for the masses, but a lot of that plot was incorporated into the backup stories in The Flash. And I was curious about, at the end of issue six, there was promoted for issue number seven, and I'm sorry if I'm getting totally fanboy on this, I'm just curious about these details. Number seven, it was promoted as the next issue would feature somebody called the Reptile Man.
I have no idea.
Okay, fair enough.
Actually, the Reptile Man became Killer Croc.
Did he really?
Yeah, I think that's where that ended up, because I wanted to do a reptilian villain, you know, of some kind. And when I was doing Batman, I was looking for something that would be very physical and very dark, you know, and bring Batman down into an environment that he wasn't accustomed to, which is, you know, underground, because he's a person who would be on the rooftops of places instead. Mm-hmm. Had him down in the sewers. And so doing a reptilian character seemed like a cool thing to do. And I don't know where the name Killer Croc came from, but, you know, I'm very happy it did, because it's one of my more successful characters outside of Firestorm. The Firestorm and Killer Croc and Punisher are the three characters that have the most media and most ancillary, you know, usages. So it's kind of cool.
I did not realize Killer Croc was one of yours. And now that you say it, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I knew about your run on Batman. And and wow, I mean, what a character that has taken off as one of Batman's, you know, most recognizable rogues. That's great.
Well, and I totally credit, you know, the Batman cartoon. Because they apparently pulled him into the cartoon for their own purposes. You know, they needed it, probably very similar to mine, you know, which was, you know, put him in a different environment. And because of that, you know, now he's like everywhere. All these toys, and I again, this is one of those characters that we got profit participation in. So, very nice to have it happening.
That's nice. Good. Now, when the DC implosion did occur, you were involved with a number of projects besides Firestorm that were affected. Things like Steel, Vixen, Dead Man for Showcase, and Deserter, and I think there may have been one or two others. How were you notified about the cancellation? How did it affect your career?
Well, I mean, it didn't affect my career in a day-to-day sense, because I had a contract to write a number of pages a month for DC. But it was a devastating blow emotionally, because I was very invested with a lot of this material. I was very invested in Firestorm, a little less so in Steel, but I still, you know, was very passionate about it. And I was looking forward to Vixen, although I wasn't happy with the original art that we got on that first issue by Winmore. I think it was Winmore. No, I don't remember who it was. But, you know, these were projects that I was looking forward to doing, and they all went away. And I think I got the call from my editor on Firestorm, Jack, who was also the editor, I think, on Steel, Jack Harris, to tell me about it. And that was not good news. Not a good day. I think it was really foolish, you know, but a lot of the decisions that got made at DC for many years were made not by people at DC thinking through what they needed to do, but by corporate bean counters, you know, who said, oh, well, you're spending too much money. We want you to cut back. So they ended up cutting back, and I think really damaged DC's ability to expand their marketplace share for a number of years as a result.
Now, I don't know my DC history as well. Was it owned by Warner Brothers at the time?
Yes.
Or was that?
Yeah. Okay. DC was bought by, what was the name of the company? There was this company in New York City that owned parking lots, bought DC back in, was it the late 60s? I think it was, And then they also bought Warner Brothers. I'm pretty sure that's how it went. You know, I'm not absolutely 100% sure, but they Warner's owned them, or this company owned them from about the late 1960s on.
Okay.
And Warner's, I think, before the Superman movie really took off, and then the Batman movie took off, never really saw DC as the potential for the potential that it had. You know, it was sort of the bastard child. It was there. It was making them some money. They didn't really care that much about it. There were no executives who read comics or knew anything about comics. You know, today, a lot of executives in the film world have comic book DNA. You know, I mean, they've either grown up reading the comics, or they're young enough so that they're familiar with the material from their contemporaries. The perception at the corporate level was that this was a not particularly worthwhile endeavor. And the idea of expanding the line to them just seemed like an unnecessary expense for no real returns. They couldn't see that there'd be any returns from it. Because there weren't. You know, I mean, realistically, the whole superhero explosion into films, television, and multimedia, you know, only occurred in the 90s, really. If then, you know, I mean, you could really argue it only took place in the last 5-7 years. So I don't know that they were wrong, but they certainly cut the legs out from under us.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Absolutely. Jumping forward a number of years there, what were the circumstances surrounding you leaving the Fury of Firestorm title?
Well, I think I was getting burned out as a writer. I was having a number of writer blocks experiences. I'd been working in television, in film, as well as in comics at that point. This was the early 1980s, mid 1980s. I was also having a crisis in my personal life, and I wasn't writing up to my best as far as I could tell. But beyond that, I wasn't really getting along with people, you know, at the company. I mean, I was really unhappy with the people who were working with editorially. And, you know, there was this general sense, I think, that there was time for a change, you know, at DC. They wanted to bring in new writers. They wanted to, you know, shake things up. And they didn't feel like I was part of that process, you know, that I would be able to contribute to that. And I didn't feel like I wanted to suffer the fools that I saw around me. and they really weren't, you know, they weren't fools, and you know, they had their own perception, and it was kind of an unfortunate blow up when you come down to it. So I left first as editor. They fired me as editor on Firestorm, and replaced me with someone who was really there just to be a caretaker, and not really interfere with the book creatively. But it that started unraveling for me, my commitment to the material. And then, you know, the work suffered, and ultimately they felt I should go, and I felt I should go. So I went.
Right. Well, you certainly had a very successful career after you left the comics field.
Oh, yeah. It was actually absolutely the best thing that could have happened to me, because it got me out of a rut that I had fallen into. And it changed my approach to my work as a writer. I had a couple of really dark years where I was very unhappy. But once I got out of that and recommitted myself to my work, you know, things really improved in a dramatic sense. So it was not fun at the time, but like many things, you know, when a door closes, another one opens.
It's fantastic. Yeah, I know it didn't, in my own experience, there's certain things that have not been fun I've had to go through, but on the other side, it was better that I went through the experience.
Oh, absolutely. Well, as what was it? It's either Hemingway or Nietzsche who says, that which did not kill you makes you stronger.
Absolutely.
And this was an unpleasant experience. It converged with a lot of other unpleasant experiences. But once I, you know, once I got through them, you know, I mean, there's a sense of empowerment, you know, in that you realize you can survive anything. So, and if you don't, well, that's the way it is, you know. But if you survived this, you know, it raises your sense of confidence in yourself that you can survive other things.
Well, assuming, let's just kind of play hypothetical. Assuming some of those things that happened to you towards the end of your run of the series hadn't come to be, we know every character evolves as time goes on. What changes in, do you think you would have made to the Firestorm title if you'd stayed around?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I mean, I was pretty happy with the dynamic that was there, so I don't know that I would have changed anything as dramatically as it was changed by other writers. I think just as they're trying to bring back at DC now the iconic characters of the 60s, you know, as the main versions of the characters that are out there for fans to follow, I think DC took the character in directions that was not necessary to go in order to maintain his viability. Mm-hmm. I never read any of the Ostrander issues, you know, where he became this supernatural force of some kind. So I really can't speak about it, but I know that I didn't think it was a good idea. Well, I figured if you're going to kill off Firestorm as they wanted to do at one point, killing off Ronnie Raymond made sense. But if you're going to bring Firestorm back, how can you bring him back without Ronnie Raymond and the Professor? Because that's who they are. That's
right.
Who he is. So I don't really quite get, you know, the new take on him. And I'm hopeful that, you know, maybe when when the dust settles from the Blackest Night storylines, you know, that will be one of the characters that they bring back to its iconic form. But who knows?
Yeah. I'm not going to pry, but have they told you?
Nope. But I do know that their intention, and I can't imagine that this wouldn't be true for Firestorm as well, that their intention is to bring all of their main characters back to the iconic versions, you know, the Hal Jordan, the Barry Allen, you know, and so on, you know, the rather than, you know, the variations that have occurred over the years. So
sure.
I guess, you know, that would make sense to me. You know, if you're going to do it with these other characters, I mean, Firestorm is a fairly popular character for them now, you know, if not in his own title, at least, you know, as a character, you know, that's used, you know, in a variety of ways. I think they'd be more successful with him that way. But I'm conservative in my love of characters. I don't like to, I mean, I am the guy who killed off Gwen Stacy, yes, but I actually prefer to see characters in their iconic forms, you know, I mean, unchanged. So I don't think I would have changed Firestorm in his fundamental dynamics, but I would have changed things up around him, you know, as time went by.
I think with the Jason Rush version of Firestorm, I think it took them a long time to sort of find their feet there, and Stuart Moore had a decent run on the book that I don't think he was intentionally trying to mirror what you had done, but there was definitely a lot more of that spirit of the Firestorm character you had had there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that was probably when people began to embrace him more.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's got to be fun. I mean, he's not a character that can be dark because he's
Exactly. Bright
red and yellow.
And his head's on fire.
And his head's on fire. And he's fundamentally silly. So if you can't embrace that, then don't do it. You know, that's my attitude. You know, don't change. I mean, I find that it's a mentality that was prevalent among people who were writing the film versions of superhero characters for a number of years before, say, the first X-Men movie came along.
Mm-hmm.
these people, for whatever reason, could not embrace the character as written. So they would try to change them and make them more something that they themselves could relate to. Well, honestly, if you don't want to do the character, then don't do the character. Do something else. You know, just don't write. If you don't want to write Batman, don't write Batman. You know, do something else. So I don't get it. You know, when I think comics went through a period in the late 80s through most of the 90s. Where there were a lot of writers and artists who didn't want to do the characters, and yet right. They had to do them. So they would just basically not do them. They would do other characters, other versions, you know, and it's like, so don't do that. It's my attitude.
What's interesting that for the Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon, they've recently announced that Firestorm's going to be on there, and the mix will be Jason Rush with Ronnie Raymond as the sort of onboard Jiminy Cricket.
That's funny.
So that's interesting to see. I don't know if that's tied to what they're going to do in comics
sort
or
of
not.
But blind leading the blind, but you know, what the heck?
they're trying to reverse the dynamic you created is what I read. They're trying to go with this, because they've kind of built him up as kind of a book smart college, you know, chemist guy. So they're trying to reverse the dynamic of Jason, the smart guy in control of the body, with the more action-oriented job.
I have to tell you, I don't think that works, because the whole point is that the person giving advice has to be giving the good advice.
Right.
That is being ignored by the person who is acting, you know, because otherwise the dynamic is the smart guy's in charge, so he's going to do the smart thing, and the other guy is just going to say, don't do that, and then he looks like an idiot. It's much more fun if the guy who's in charge doesn't quite know what he's doing. That's me. I mean, but that's my take on it, you know, and obviously, you know, I'm biased in, you know, in perceiving my own stuff as brilliant. But there's a reason. There is a reason why the character, you know, it has some legs. Because I think all the good superhero characters, to one degree or another, tap into something that is basic inside us. You know, either some wish fulfillment or some understanding of ourselves. And what I thought I tapped into with Ronnie was the Firestorm the pain of growing up. You know. And the difficulty of growing up, where you're a teenager, you're feeling all this incredible power in yourself, all these potential things that you can do, but there's this outside presence, you know, that says to you what you can and cannot do, and what you should do and how you should do it. And it always seems to know best, but doesn't really, you know, let you be yourself, and so on. So that's the dynamic. You know, that I thought I tapped into with that. And that's the iconic version of the character that I think if they really want to be successful with him, that they're going to have to find a way to get back to. But I don't know if they're going to do that, because there's been a lot of damage done over the years.
Yeah. I think that really did sums up a good core of his essence there. It really is a I mean, you created him. Of course, you have a good handle on him. I'm sorry, but that's a really good summation.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not that I knew that I was doing that, because I'm a fairly instinctive writer, but what ends up happening for me is that I can look back on material and say, oh, that's what that was. You know, it's like part of that is what I was trying to get across in the Animal Man miniseries was, you know, how when you look back on your life, you ask questions that you would not have asked why you were going through it. And sometimes the answer is simply the question, you know, that you're asking. In the case of Firestorm, you know, it's like, it's pretty clear to me what makes him appealing to a reader. But you know, they've messed it up somewhat over the years. And I would hope that they find a way to get back to it. I mean, it doesn't have to be Professor Stein, you know, I mean, it could be a different older, I mean, make it an older woman, for God's sake. You could do that. You know, you could do any number of things with it, but the dynamic.
I always thought Ray Palmer would be interesting.
Yeah, Ray Palmer. I mean, you know, or exactly. Bring in some, if you want to bring in an iconic DC character, you could do that. I personally rather see Ray Palmer as the Atom, but, you know, and I think that's where they're going to go with that too. So
yeah,
it's, you gotta just sort of accept that certain things work for a reason. Batman works because Bruce Wayne had a horrible childhood. Batman as Dick Grayson as Batman, I don't think so. And they're not going to do that. You know, I mean, that's just simply a way for them to stir things up so that you as a reader get angry or disappoint or want to see something. And then when Bruce comes back, it'll be such a big relief, you know, that he's back. But, you know, for the lesser characters, I think there's less, weight given to the original interpretation.
Okay, folks, this seems like as good a stopping point as any, so we're going to go ahead and pause the interview here. So swing by firestormfan.com in a couple of days to hear the rest of the interview with Jerry. So thanks so much. Bye.
Legendary Superpowers Show.